You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Dick Meyer has been a reporter, producer, online editor, and columnist for CBS News, and now he is the editorial director of digital media for NPR. Along the way, he's been witness to more than two decades of social change. In his new book, Why We Hate Us, American Discontent in the New Millennium, he goes so far as to say that these changes have resulted in a 21st century mood disorder. His book is published by Crown, and I'm very pleased it has brought Dick Meyer to the show today. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me. It's nice.
You say we're morally and existentially tired, disoriented, ankleless, and offensive. It sounds just awful. Is that why
it's
I
a
don't
real
want
upper.
To get out of
I've
bed
tried,
in the morning?
Well, if you don't want to get out of bed, that might have something to do with it. I hope the book isn't quite that much of a downer. I do have some silver linings in the whole thing, but generally, I think it's kind of true.
And you say it's the fallout of the informational revolution. How are they related?
Well, I guess maybe the informational revolution at the turn of the century is the second of a 1-2 punch that I think has disoriented society. Let me give you the number one punch first to work it. I think in the past 50 years, America has gone through a tremendous kind of social change on many levels. The first part of it was the 1960s, symbolically, not literally. But there were two great things that happened in the 1960s, apart from all the wonderful things that happened in terms of civil rights and rights for minorities. One thing is that society became much more mobile. People no longer lived in the hometowns where they grew up. They decided whether they were going to get married, how they were going to work, where they were going to live. Life became a choice instead of being what you inherited from your community or inherited from your parents in terms of values. Those were two big kind of changes that disoriented the society a lot, obviously. We all know that about the 60s. Then, wham, at the turn of the century, there's this phenomenal technological revolution that gives us all BlackBerries and cell phones and 24/7 access to the news in the United States as well as South Africa. The whole world is brought to us. And what that technology has done, among many other things, has speeded up our lives. And it's given us kind of the information overload is a cliche, but it's a true thing. So I think this sort of 1-2 punch of change coming from the mobility, the lack of social tradition on top of this big change in the pace of our lives has been very, very hard for us to cope with.
You say that bad manners are a perversion of 60s idealism. So the 60s started off with the sense that things were going to change, but what changed wasn't necessarily what you would have liked to have seen.
Well, I think what was obviously wonderful about the 1960s is that a lot of tired old conventions, some of which were very prejudiced, some of which were very hard on society's marginal people, were cast aside. I mean, the developments with civil rights, of course, were probably the greatest progress our country's made in 60 years. But on the other hand, there was kind of a rejection of what was considered conventional behavior. And it was seen as more existentially authentic or intense to let it all hang out. You shouldn't hold the door open for a woman just because that was done. You know, everybody's equal.
Manners require conformity.
Exactly. Conformity came to be kind of a sense of being an existential weakling. But personally, I think that manners are the way that Homo sapiens signal respect for each other. It's the way we signal respect for strangers. The lack of that, I think, has been very, very hard on society. So, in some ways, the lack of manners started with the idealistic aspiration for self-expression. I got to be me. I got to do what I want. In the end, that's a little bit of a narcissistic impulse. It doesn't consider the other.
I recently saw the revival of hair in Central Park, and what's quite obvious is the desire to shock. All sorts of obscene words are used, and at a certain point, everybody takes up their clothes, although it's done so dimly, it doesn't really matter. But that was all part of something that people have nostalgia for now. The audience, some people in the audience were crying because those were the good old days. But how much of your concern is based on nostalgia of another sort? In my days, the children addressed their elders as sir and ma'am. Isn't there a little bit of that in your book?
You know, I'm widely accused of two things. One is being nostalgic, and the other is being an old cranky curmudgeon. Honestly, I've got to plead guilty a little bit to both. I am a little bit nostalgic, but I really do think that I've done enough reporting on this to be very realistic about what communities were in the sort of generally post-60s America. They weren't ideals. They weren't utopian at all. If you were a person that didn't fit into those communities for whatever reasons, because of race, because of sexual preference, these were terrible places to be, and they're much better places to be now. But empirically, and the kind of stuff I write about in the book, it's difficult to prove it with statistics and polls. But empirically, you can really get at a handle for how much community has degraded in the most simple sense. People simply have fewer lifelong relationships than they did 40, 50 years ago. They have fewer relationships with relatives and people of generations who live physically near them, who they can see every day. And that is an enormously important ingredient in human happiness that we've lost. So I don't think it's nostalgic. I think it's pretty realistic.
My guest is Dick Meyer, who's written a book called Why We Hate Us, American Discontent in the New Millennium, published by Crown. And I have to tell you, when I first saw it, I thought, well, this is something different, because all the books we've been seeing recently have been with titles like Why They Hate Us. But you're saying that not only should we be looking at why the rest of the world is questioning what America's all about, but that we've been doing it ourselves?
I think what we haven't been doing is looking at the mirror well enough. Obviously, the title of the book came to me. There was the famous Newsweek cover that came after the tragedies of 9/11, and the title of Newsweek was Why They Hate Us. Why do the Islamist terrorists hate us so much?
And why do the Europeans hate us?
Exactly. I mean, why and all of that. But after I was struck by how quickly the goodwill, the communitarian aspects that we all felt after 9/11 dissipated. And it was shocking to me how soon after that we sort of lost our self-esteem. And I started looking at that more systematically. And what I realized is, in my view, from a lot of reporting, whether it's urban yuppies or rural homeschoolers, Americans, and I deeply believe this, Americans feel that there's something that's happened with the prevailing culture that has gotten quite toxic.
Is that why we have seen a growth in religious fundamentalism, because there's a feeling that the moral codes have eroded?
I'm not a religious expert, but I would say that's sort of part B. Part A, I think, is that, as I've said before, community has corroded. And without community, it is just very difficult, to put it in blunt terms, it's very difficult for Homo sapiens to find happiness and contentment. That's the single biggest. So I think a big part of the urge to belong religiously is the urge to connect. But yes, absolutely, so many of our inherited social traditions, religious or not, have declined since the 1960s. It's hard for people to make their own choices about how to live, you know, and we've lost respect for the traditions that have been time-tested through the generations.
Is this specifically American, or would somebody in France have written a similar book?
I think that there are aspects of this that are absolutely American. I mean, I think the main thing that is very, very American is what I call selfism. It's a kind of belief that was spawned in the 1960s, but it preyed on something much older. It preyed on the Ben Franklin idea of the American is the self-made man. In Europe, in Benjamin Franklin's time, you could only be what your caste was, what your father's job was, what your class said you could be. In America, you could be the pioneer. You could be the self-made man. After the 60s, this ideal kind of got perverted. And as people rejected their social inheritance, everything became a matter of choice. Your religion, whether you were going to have kids or not, where you lived, and all of that seems great. I mean, that's the ideal, right? Isn't freedom of choice the idea? Well, it turned out to be that's a very tough recipe, A, for human happiness, and also for humans to live well together.
So we should have fewer choices?
I actually think that you can make that argument. It's very hard to make that argument in a capitalist democracy. More choice, I mean, what the psychiatrist will tell you for certain is more choice after the basic creates stress. For instance, if you go into a store and there are six kinds of shampoo, you're happy. If there are 95 kinds of shampoo, you think, oh my God, what if I get one that damages my hair? What if it dries out my hair? What if it gets kinky? It creates stress. Maybe that's a little bit of a trivial example.
Well, let's look at another kind of choice. Right now, we have all sorts of ways of connecting with other people, or maybe we're not connecting well. But yesterday I had a conversation with somebody, and I said, well, I don't look at my email after I get home. I leave the office, and that's that. And then sometimes I check in on the weekend, but I really do not want to become a slave to it. And she said, I have to learn to set those boundaries. And that's those people who sit in the theater as the movie is starting and they're still clicking their BlackBerries or now their iPhones, that's because they have a lot of choices, isn't it? In the past, we just would have sat there quietly, waited for the movie to come on and watched it and then gotten up and gone and done the next thing.
No, I don't think it is because they have a lot of choices. I think it's for two things. A, they don't have manners. And I know the word manners has become a Neanderthal, neoconservative, geezerish word, but I'm a big believer in manners. I'm a big believer that manners are how we people, we featherless bipeds, signal respect to strangers and people. Technology has wrought a lot of bad manners in public. People just become socially oblivious if they can touch their little iPod or cell phone. So that's part one. The other is that somehow people, because of the technology, need to feel very connected to something, but it's not necessarily the people that we're with. And one of the epic historical changes of the beginning of the 21st century that I really don't think we've got a handle on is how much the sheer quantity of media that invades our life. And by media, I mean anything that's a mediated thing.
Which you call omnimedia in this book.
I use the phrase omnimedia, and I try not
to. Somebody's now copywriting it and starting a company.
Oh, great. I hope – can you help me get a slice of that? I think you know, people argue, is the media good? Is the media biased? Is the media conservative, liberal, whatever? To me, the stunning thing is the amount of screen time and electronic time Americans have, especially the youth. And I think it does funny things to our cognitive processing and also to our social life.
And we'll come back to that as we continue this conversation. My guest is Dick Meyer, who was a reporter, producer, online editor, and columnist at CBS News in Washington for over 23 years. Now he is the editorial director of digital media at National Public Radio, and he has written a book called Why We Hate Us, American Discontent in the New Millennium. It is published by Crown. Stay with us. And you won't want to go away because later in this hour, Ron Suskind will be here to talk about his explosive book about how America lost its moral authority while trying to win the war on terror. And then on political projections, we discuss how Hollywood has portrayed politicians who are clearly the wrong ones for the job. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Our entire show is available as a podcast. We're back with Dick Meyer, whose book is Why We Hate Us, American Discontent in the New Millennium, published by Crown. And as I said, you were at CBS for 23 years, now at NPR. What got you writing this book, the CBS experience or the NPR experience?
Well, it was finished by the time that I came to NPR, but certainly I'm proud to have it in more my portfolio as I got to NPR.
You say that the omnimedia, as you call them, trivialize ideas and images. In what way? I mean, you're a member of the omnimedia.
I guess I could be accused of being a self-loathing member of the Omnimedia.
Why I Hate Me.
Why I Hate Me. And believe me, you're not the first to mention that. You're not even the first at my dinner table at home all the time who's mentioned that. You know, I spent 23 years at CBS, mostly as a reporter, and I was really very proud of the work I did as a reporter, as a fact gatherer and a news gatherer, and at CBSNews.com. But the world has just changed immensely in the amount of media that's available to people in the course of the day. And the sheer quantity of it, it's as if its media experience is transplanting real experience. Kids, people our age, are spending so much time with screens and devices and little keyboards. I mean, it is a true thing that they're spending less time with human beings. Now, obviously, there's so much media that there's more of the outside world that can be brought in to a human's life than ever before in human history. You can see the outside world by staying at home on your screens. I mean, if you lived 300 years ago, you had no idea what Europe looked like or what Turkey looked like or what Africa looked like. Now you can get a click and you could read papers from them. And in some ways, I mean, it seems like it should be an enormous opportunity for humankind. On the other side, it makes things look smaller. Now, and I think we're seeing that with our politicians and our leaders. It's almost impossible for a leader to survive in the scrutiny of kind of 24/7 omnimedia. It devours us in a way.
And it leads to accusations of politicians being celebrities, although I think we should be very pleased that the Republicans never stooped to running celebrities like Ronald Reagan or Arnold Schwarzenegger or Fred Thompson or George Murphy for political office.
You know, I've really tried hard to think that this was kind of going to be a turning point election, because I think both Obama and McCain are trying to do things differently, if only on the edges. When McCain ran this ad comparing Barack Obama to Britney Spears, I got to tell you, I didn't feel like that was a high point for my theory.
I was amused to read that that Paris Hilton's mother was really upset after all she gave so much money to the McCain campaign.
The thing about this is if a society could look in the big mirror, what does it say about us that we spend so much time worrying about the Lindsay Lohans, the Britney Spears, the Anna Nicole Smiths?
Well, you were part of that at CBS, weren't you? And you watched it happen more and more. And some people try to hold back the flood, but they have wound up losing this war, and we're seeing it in newspapers. I just read the other day that the man who was hired to as an advisor for the Tribune group by the new owner has complained that newspapers are too NPR-like.
That's a new one to me. I've certainly never heard newspapers.
You said we want them to be intelligent but not intellectual.
I don't know what that means. I would hope all of us would inspire to be both. While also aspiring to being plain spoken. Yes, I was part of it. You know, I certainly tried to hold my position in sticking with more traditional news. On the internet, it was always a different kind of dilemma than when I was in broadcast or somebody in print. When you're on broadcast, as you obviously know, you have 60 minutes and that's it. It's a zero-sum game. If you put something in the show, you take something out.
Well, actually, I have 120 minutes.
As an example. Or if you're a newspaper, you have X number of pages. It's different in the internet. There's an infinite amount of space. Put it this way. I am glad to have the opportunity to not do that at National Public Radio right now.
I get the feeling that you, along with many other people, feel that the satirists these days are getting closer to the truth. The Onion sometimes seems to report the news better, or someone like Stephen Colbert. And you refer to his word truthiness, Colbert's word truthiness, as being really on target.
Well, but sad at the same time. I don't think the satirists necessarily are getting closer to the truth, but everybody is so jaded. Everybody is so used to being deconstructing reality now and being a phoniness spotter that it's as if the satirists and the comedians are the only ones that have any credibility, because the people who listen to the mainstream news, they think that it's sort of BS, pardon my French, and they know that with the satirists, they're not trying to spin them, and so they have a different kind of credibility. Colbert's word truthiness, I think, absolutely nails the time. Truthiness is, if I believe it, if I feel it in my gut, then it's truthy. But the problem with truthiness, of course, is you can't argue with truthiness. There's no rational way to adjudicate between competing truthiness claims. And that's society cannot function like that.
But hasn't relative truth always been a major issue in journalism? That dream, that fantasy of objective journalism has been pretty much exploded again and again over the years.
Well, there's truth in as it's used in journalism, and there's truth as a term that's used more by philosophers, preachers, and people in the moral context. I think the idea of truth as used by mainstream media in this country for the past 60 years, yeah, that's been changed a lot. Nobody claims that that mainstream media, that reporters get at the truth right now, but they give it their darndest to report true facts and tell both sides of the story. But the idea of truth in the other context is, okay, maybe we don't know what the God-given objective truth is, but can't we agree on a vocabulary, on terms, for points of logic, so that we can discuss with the same vocabulary what is and what is not closer to the truth.
Well, in a few minutes, I'll be talking with Ron Suskind, whose new book says that a lot of what we read in the newspapers in the run-up to the war and after the war turned out to not be true. And journalists perhaps could have gotten the stories if they had dug a little deeper. To some degree, it was because politicians were fabricating things and lying to us. My only sense here is that this is not new. That's my main objection to what you're saying here. I think this has always been a problem, and the problem has always been that the press has not really done its job. Once in a while it has, but look at how long Woodward and Bernstein had to fight to get their stories published against great resistance before anybody even took Watergate seriously.
I guess I'd urge you to shift focus. If you look at the press during colonial times, during the glory days of our founding fathers, you could not find a worse example of the press. I mean, it was all completely biased. It was pamphleteering. It was nothing but opinion. Having a good press in America, a hardworking, honest press, has been the aberration in our history. I think what I'm arguing about truth and truthiness applies less to the press and to current events, although it does. I mean, the truthiness and the spin and marketing absolutely dominates politics right now, because politics is dominated not by governing, it's dominated by campaigning. And campaigning is a form of marketing, and we're kidding ourselves if we think otherwise. But I think there's another a whole arena where we look at our lives, where we look at how we are as parents, how we are as citizens, where we have accepted in a way that's very new the idea of relative truth only, and there's nothing more than relative truth and anything goes if I like it.
My guest is Dick Meyer, who's written a book called Why We Hate Us, American Discontent in the New Millennium. It's published by Crown. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and you brought up politics, and earlier you mentioned phoniness, and in one of your chapters, A Civic War, you put the two together. Now, phoniness, again, isn't that always been part of the political process?
To some degree.
I mean, George Washington may have been a man of real integrity, but even Abraham Lincoln lied during his campaigns.
You know what? It's completely changed. Yes, phoniness, a little bit of spin, a little bit of chicanery. Of course, it's endemic. It's probably been true since Socrates was paling around on the Parthenon. It's changed radically since the 1960s, and Watergate. And the big reason for that is that politicians decided that the key thing was not the way they governed, but was to govern in a way that they could make sure that they could get reelected. And so the way they governed started to become dominated by campaigning. And we developed perpetual campaigns. Political parties weakened immensely after the reforms of Watergate, and they were replaced by political consultants, and they became the new gurus. And these were not policy people. These were marketers. And the primary way that campaigning happens and political marketing happens now is through the media. It's not through face-to-face. So it's very different than at prior times in American history, and it's very different because of the role of the media.
And different Americans are engaged in the political process than in the past, and many are turned off. People who might have been engaged in the past seem to be often turned off, and people who didn't seem to be all that interested in the past, for example, evangelicals, are now deeply engaged, to some degree because politics has also been changed into something like a culture war. And you talk about Patrick Buchanan's speech before the 1992 Republican National Convention in that regard.
Well, actually, I would differ a little bit on that, because if I had to give one example of the phoniness that we believe about American politics, it's that the nation is divided into red and blue states and there's a culture war going on. That is the absolute dominant story.
You don't agree with Thomas Frank, whatever happened to Kansas?
No, I think it's demonstrably true that there is not a culture war in America, that America is not divided into red and blue states. What has happened, and this is really easy to prove with the data, by far the majority of Americans are inconsistent in their political views. They have different views depending on the issue. Most of their views are very moderate. They're very much in the middle. They're eclectic, and they are not ideological. On the edges, you do have a slight increase on the very liberal and the very conservative, but what you have a massive increase is in the intensity of feelings of people on the extremes. Liberals, and this has been proven very clearly, liberals dislike conservatives much more than they did 25 years ago, and vice versa. So all the great people in the middle, once we called them the silent majority, they're sort of middle-of-the-road people. They're very conservative on one issue but inconsistently liberal on another. If they're given a choice between two parties they dislike, they split evenly. And that's why we don't have close elections, because the country is bitterly divided. We have close elections because people don't like either party, and so they split evenly between the two of them.
So why do you think the idea that there is this culture war that's dividing Americans, a culture war between the Democrats and the Republicans, has been so prominent? It's had such strong legs.
It's easy. There are two answers. It's a great story. It's a dramatic story for the media to tell, campaign after campaign after campaign. America's divided into red and blue, and they're clashing right now. And the second reason is that it's a very strong campaign tactic. It's something that campaign consultants and marketers use to try to scare the other side. It makes for a kind of extreme rhetoric. And it is true that people who are very engaged in American politics, the political elite, who are either in it for a living or do things like we do in the media, these people are extreme. Most people aren't. So it makes for very potent marketing, but it doesn't reflect the real truth out there. And that, I think, is the greatest phoniness of American politics.
And is this the fault of the politicians or again, the fault of the press? Because some have said that one of the problems is the press loves a narrative. And so we had Al Gore as the guy who claimed that he invented the internet, and George Bush as the bumbling, likable cowboy. Narratives that turn out not really to be true, but the press really ran with them. And we're seeing the same sort of thing developing during this campaign as well. Is that because Americans are demanding it, because this is the best way that the press finds to tell the story? Or is there some truth to that approach?
I think I'm going to say something unpopular. yes, it's the media's fault. We're suckers for a media, for a story. We're suckers for a simple narrative. Yes, it's the politicians' approach because they have found that this seems to be an effective way of campaigning, an effective way of holding on to their incumbent offices. But I think it's the fault of us as citizens, as the American citizens, for somehow not demanding more. I mean, I'm just not a person who believes that you can look at elites like the press, like the media, or like politicians, and say, well, somehow they're just not representing all of us. And I think that's the difficult equation we face in trying to understand society.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from your colleagues at NPR and your old friends at CBS?
You know, I can't tell you at this point that I've gotten a tremendous amount. The people who have read the book at both places, I've really enjoyed, to be honest, the feedback I've gotten, because we have focused a lot on the politics and the big picture. There's a lot in the book that has more to do with everyday life and how an individual copes with living in what I've called an age of phoniness.
Well, you even talk about Botox, and I didn't bring it up because I didn't want people to think that I was talking about that I would accuse you of trivializing some things.
Well,
why does Botox bother you? If somebody wants to do it, even and everybody spots it and says, "Oh, gee, she obviously has had some work done."
You know what? I suppose on an individual level, it doesn't bother me in any specific person. The idea that so much of our society could be so discontented with the natural evolution of their body that people are willing to go into debt to have plastic surgery, or that we could have a reality show dedicated to extreme makeovers. Call me a weirdo. I think that's pretty profoundly alienated.
Well, welcome to Why We Hate Us, another kind of reality show. Why We Hate Us, Dick Meyer's book, American Discontent in the New Millennium, published by Crown. Thank you so much for coming by and talking with us.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Up next, Ron Suskind explains why he thinks that the Bush administration knew there were no weapons of mass destruction before the invasion of Iraq, and many other stories. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.